tonight on Arena. It's all about the seasons, winter and spring with the Irish Chamber Orchestra and summer from the author Ali Smith. You can text us on 51551 or tweet at RTE Arena. 2020 was supposed to be a very busy year for the Irish Chamber Orchestra, with the release of a new album and a tour in Germany. Just two of the plans on the horizon. But like so many other artistic endeavours, the tour had to be put on hold because of the pandemic. However, as part of a daring move by Kilkenny Arts Festival, the Irish Chamber Orchestra will be performing together again this weekend. The orchestra will play two concerts in the open air in the yard of Kilkenny Castle this Sunday coming, August the 16th. The programme for both concerts include Vivaldi's Four Seasons along with Piazzolla's Four Seasons of Buenos Aires. A real treat for classical music fans who have been starved of live performance for most of the year. In a moment, I'll be talking to the leader of the Irish Chamber Orchestra, violinist Catherine Hunke. But first, let's have a sample of what audience can expect this Sunday. This was recorded in July 2015 in Rathkeel, County Limerick. And it's a sample of Catherine's stunning violin playing, an extract from Vivaldi's Four Seasons, Winter. An extract there from Vivaldi's Four Seasons, Winter, from the Irish Chamber Orchestra, recorded back in July 2015. And I'm joined by Catherine Hunke, the leader of the Irish Chamber Orchestra. It must be very exciting, this idea of the Chamber Orchestra doing a live performance, is it, Catherine?
It's an incredible feeling, actually. Just listening to that, even, I get to do that on Sunday. It's incredible because we haven't played together for 6 months.
So how have you been keeping in touch?
Because we're usually so busy, you know. Well, I phone them. We all phone each other. We've had the odd Zoom drink, which is fun. But you know yourself, with Zoom, you all have to talk. You can't all talk at once. And we do all talk at once. So we haven't had the usual banter. It's going to be absolutely lovely to see everybody again.
So what's going to happen now in Kilkenny, in the yard of Kilkenny Castle?
Olga Barry, who organises the festival, is a very gutsy and brave lady. And she, because originally this performance was in St. Canice's, which is, I don't know if you've been in there, but it's a massive
Indeed.
Cathedral. But the current restrictions mean you can only have 50 in a space. And I long for the moment that it's different if you're in a cathedral and if you're in your house, because it meant that if we were only allowed 50 in that space, then we're 20 already. So it was going to be an audience of sort of 25, 30 people. And like making this move to come out and play again, we've got to feed as many souls as we can, you know? That's the plan. So Olga made the move that we play outside. So I'm in touch with the weather gods right now. Actually, I just heard the weather for tonight is yellow rain warning in Kilkenny, which surely means that all the rain will be gone by Sunday. Right?
Surely. What will the setup in the yard be? Do you have to socially distance from the rest of your 19 performers?
Yeah, we do. So I mean, we have to be incredibly careful going back to work. I mean, the rules are, there's a lot of rules, and rightly so. So we are all going to each going to be 2 meters apart from each other. And then the audience will be in, I think, I understand, obviously, I'm not part of this side of things, but
sure.
I think the audience will be in clusters of people spaced out. And, you know, so the organisation that goes into something like this is huge. But hopefully if we start doing it now, then people will learn. We'll learn what we need to do and it will be easier the next time.
Yes, and I suppose it's too early to know, will this spacing have any effect on the acoustics of playing together?
Yeah, I don't think so. I've done performances before where we're in all different bits of the concert hall. You know, I'm all for bringing classical music to people in a slightly less formal, rigid way. So I'd be all for music being made in all kinds of different spaces with the orchestra and not necessarily in a group on the stage. So I don't think that this will affect the enjoyment of the audience one bit. And no, I think it will be fine. But for us, of course, in rehearsal, we'll be adjusting to just being that little bit further apart.
So that was Vivaldi's Winter from the Four Seasons that we heard there. And I think most people are fairly familiar with the wonderful Vivaldi and his Four Seasons. This concert is called the Eight Seasons. And as well as Vivaldi, you're doing the composer Piazzolla's Argentinian composition, which is the Four Seasons of Buenos Aires. Is that a very different proposition to Vivaldi?
It really is. It really is. It's red hot, the Piazzolla. It's sultry and South American music at its most exciting, I think. And we actually recorded those seasons, the Piazzolla seasons, and they were released in April. And so that was part of that, something that did happen during this lockdown. To actually come out and play it on Sunday is going to be liberating in the extreme. It's party music.
Yes, because when you think of Buenos Aires and Argentina, you think of tango. And he was the creator of the Nuevo Tango. So is that very present in his Four Seasons?
Yeah, very much so. Yeah, it's rhythmic and a lot of heart. And a lot of it's absolutely music that I absolutely love to play. It's sultry and dark and oozing with affection for everything.
And during the concert, then, Catherine, as a member of the orchestra, maybe introduces each piece to the audience. Is that going to happen in Kilkenny?
Well, that's in the Vivaldi, because Vivaldi actually wrote, well, we don't know if it was definitely him, but very likely Vivaldi wrote short sonnets that go with each of the four seasons. And I always think it's a dreadful shame that the orchestra know, for example, that this bit is somebody who's drunk, or this bit is people having a party, or this is where they fall asleep. But the audience should know that, surely, as well. Otherwise, it's like an in-joke. So then I will ask a colleague, Una Kyo in the orchestra, is going to do it for us. She has a beautiful speaking voice. She will just say the bit of the sonnet that's relevant before we play each movement, so people will know if we're having a snowball fight or having a snooze. That's the idea.
Oh, how exciting. And does she do the same with the Piazzolla? Is there an introduction?
No, the Piazzolla is... it actually doesn't. It doesn't have anything written next to it. But we tend to give a signal to the audience so that they know. And I'm not even going to say what that signal is for people that might be there.
They
know which season it is.
Oh, very good. I thought it might be just a toe tapping thing. And so you made a CD of this music. So it was Piazzolla music and Schubert music.
Yeah, and a piece by Schnitker, which is kind of theatrical, quirky piece that we put on there as well. So we did record these Piazzolla pieces. So we know them inside out.
Oh, right. And that was recorded in because you said you were working on that during lockdown, but it was recorded pre-lockdown in the autumn of 2019.
That was recorded before. Yeah, but during lockdown it was released. And that was lovely because it received great reviews, and we got 5 stars for ourselves in BBC Music Magazine, which was just the boost we needed when we weren't playing at all. You know, it's a very strange feeling to get a good review when you're not playing.
Indeed, but what
but
a great thing to get.
It's great for morale, of course.
And what about you yourself? You live in Killaloe. What was lockdown like for a musician who's used to playing with other people? I mean, obviously you can still play the violin, but did you find it difficult?
Yeah, for the first little while, I felt very grateful to be living in such a beautiful place. And I felt grateful to have a bit of a rest, to be honest, because it's been quite a roller coaster of, you know, being a working mum as well. It's full on. And then, so having a rest, having time with my children, and I play music with them. My older son, Carl, is a lovely musician himself on piano and bassoon. So we play together. So we were busy. We were busy at home making music, I suppose.
Well,
but after about 3 months, that I had started to miss making music with an audience, like an ache, because something happens between audience and musicians that we can't even put our finger on. It's that wonderful. I can't even describe it. That I suppose that's why we don't try. But that's what I miss, is that thing that happens in a live space. It's so important, and of course it's so what we all need right now, because life can feel a bit bleak at times. So I would say that the arts are no luxury item right now.
So the concerts in the Yard in Kilkenny Castle are unfortunately sold out, or fortunately for you guys, but the people at home can now listen to the chamber orchestra perform some Piazzolla. Would you like to introduce Spring by Piazzolla, Catherine?
Yeah. So this excerpt from Spring, it's the last bit of Spring, and you'll hear all the moods. Actually, you hear I think that the slow bit of this is First Love. That's what I think of when I play this, and then the end is insane. It's the bit I have to practice every day. It's insane. You'll hear why. Thank you.
Piazzolla's Spring from his Four Seasons of Buenos Aires, performed by Catherine Hunka and the Irish Chamber Orchestra. No wonder they got 5 stars from the BBC. The Irish Chamber Orchestra will perform 8 seasons at the Yard at Kilkenny Castle this Sunday at 6:30 and 8 p.m. Both performances are, as I said, sold out. But for more information on Kilkenny Arts Festival, visit kilkennyarts.ie. Ali Smith's new novel, Summer, is the conclusion to her seasonal quartet following the 3 previous books, Autumn, Winter and Spring. The quartet was a hugely ambitious task that the author created for herself, to write novels set in part in the time of their writing and thus reflecting our own contemporary times. So Summer is as timely as you can get. It contains 2 narratives, one set in Britain heading into lockdown in 2020 and one looking back to 1940, when German nationals were interned as enemy aliens. The action in the present is centred on the Greenlaw family, Grace the mother, and 2 often warring children, Sasha, an activist, and Robert, who is flirting with the conservative spin machine. While we pick up on the life of Daniel Gluck, now over 100 years old and looking back on his time in a British internment camp, and Ali Smith joins me now. You're very welcome, Ali.
Oh, it's nice to be speaking to you, Kay.
This is the 4th and final novel in your seasonal quartet. And for those who have read the 3 previous books, there's a chance to re-engage with some of the characters from the other novels. But Summer is an independent book that can be read on its own.
I hope so. The idea was always to produce separate books called after the separate seasons, which if you just picked one up, you should be able to just read it on its own. But there's also an aggregative kind of force that's been happening through these books on their own, actually. I had no idea it would happen, and when it has, it's simply come round like the seasons do in a kind of a cycle. And closed its cycle, but left with any luck, left it open for the next cycle too. I hope so anyway. That's kind of what the seasons do for us, you know.
So like the others in the series, you reference contemporary events. It was the Brexit vote in autumn. Similarly in Summer, you had to write very fast to get the contemporaneousness right. You began it in January, is that correct?
It is right. I started at the end of January, but the brief I gave myself and also that I talked to my publishers about for these 4 books was that we would. It was like an experiment, like a kind of time experiment to see what happened with the novel, which is called the novel because that word means new, and it was called it because it was the newest thing. When the novel first existed, it was because it was, you know, it was called that because you had the novelty of the newest thing happening in the book as you read it. So the idea was always to try and write, nose pressed right up against the window of the contemporary, and then publish it as we went, just to see what happened. I mean, when I started these books, there was no Brexit. The word didn't even exist, Brexit. And, you know, now I'm ending it, and we're on a brand new word, COVID. We've never, you know, that's a word we didn't ever know till now. So it has been, an interesting experience just going with time. As time passed, trying to kind of sort a narrative while at the same time kind of sensing what the contemporary narrative was too. I can't say that I'm not glad to be through this experience, but at the same time, you know, there was something about writing these books that saw me through a time that was turbulent, which made me understand that narrative does see us through time, and that to look at the contemporary and see it as a narrative is not a false thing to do, because fiction is one of the ways we get closest to the truth. It's the opposite of lies, really. Fiction it's the point where the imagination and reality meet, and try and understand what it is that's happening in the human imagination, the world, and our real lives. You know,
the book is called Summer, but it begins in February in the fiction. So the characters are often remembering summers from the past, or maybe looking forward to the summer with maybe hope. But what does summer mean for you in this book?
For me, the summer was always the last book, and I was coming towards summer with the hope that I'll be working towards the light. You know, autumn we go into the darker nights, and in winter we have the most dark time, which then suddenly pivots at midwinter and begins to light again, and the light lifts and lifts and lifts until June, in summer when we got midsummer. So I was always thinking I was working towards the wide open leaf, and it made me think about the ways that we tell ourselves stories and that we think we're heading for an ending and what it is that we want, a narrative or a life or a story or a living to bring us, how we imagine. To some extent, we're always working, I think, towards the light, human beings. We're always working towards the summer.
I think you have a reading for us that really, I think, encapsulates what you're trying to show in the book about summer.
Well, this one is it's one of the characters who is new to this book, and she is at this point young and in the summer at 1989, the summer that we all called the summer of discontent, which was an incredibly warm, beautiful summer, but full of strikes and anger and a big change coming in politics just at that point, 1989. Anyway, this is her in 1989, Grace. But that's summer for you. Summer's like walking down a road just like this one, heading towards both light and dark, because summer isn't just a merry tale, because there's no merry tale without the darkness. And summer's surely really all about an imagined end. We head for it instinctually, like it must mean something. We're always looking for it, looking to it, heading towards it all year, the way a horizon holds the promise of a sunset. We're always looking for the full open leaf, the open warmth, the promise that we'll one day soon surely be able to lie back and have summer done to us. One day soon we'll be treated well by the world, like there really is a kinder finale, and it's not just possible, but assured. There's a natural harmony that'll be spread at your feet, unrolled like a sunlit landscape just for you, as if what it was always all about, your time on earth, was the full happy stretch of all the muscles of the body on a warmed patch of grass, one long sweet stem of that grass in the mouth, carefree. What a thought. Summer.
That's Ali Smith reading from Summer, her new novel. That was the character of Grace, and Grace is the mother of two siblings, Sasha and Robert. And we also have two siblings in the past, Daniel and Hannah. Can you tell us a little bit about the two sets of siblings?
I will do. There's Sasha, she's 16, and she wakes up at night scared that the world is going to burn and that climate change means the end, and how do you have a future when you're 16 looking for the world that may or may not exist in, you know, in very close years to come. And then her younger brother, Robert, he's 13, and he is a sponge. He's a cultural sponge, and he's taking in through the pores of his very self the poisons and the divisions and the, what should we say, the chicanery of a political division at the moment. And he just voices in himself that split that comes between the child and the adolescent, the knowledge and the how to hold that knowledge. So those two are at odds, but are brother and sister, and you know what that means, because families always happy and unhappy together. And then in the past, we've got Daniel, and he's a young man at this point. He's a character who's been in all the novels. And his sister Hannah. And Daniel is the English child of a German father. And his German father was interned in the First World War for 6 years. And then the Second World War comes, and Daniel, you know, comes down one morning and there's a policeman at the table and his father's being interned again, 1940. So Daniel goes into internment with his dad. And oh my goodness, Kay, the difference. I mean, I was in my reading about the difference between those two wars in the UK. Amazing to me that in 20 years the country could have changed so much. That, you know, in that First World War, enemy aliens were enemy aliens right the way through. They came out exhausted and ill after 5-6 years of incarceration. And in the 40s, the Second World War, it's like the mood had changed, and that the country knew that enemy alien was a kind of false construct, and that people were people, and the people who were in internment in that second war were in internment for much less time because people were working for them. This country changed within, you know, 20 years, became a fully open and a much kinder and a much more kind of complex understander of people in the world than it had been at the 20 years before in the First War.
Like in all the series, one thing you've done in it is introduce us to interesting artists such as Pauline Boty in Autumn. And in this novel, you return several times to Lorenza Mazzetti. Can you tell us about her? She was a filmmaker.
I will do. Lorenza Mazzetti came across to England with a bunch of students in the very early 1950s to help work on farms. However, she was really rubbish at working on farms, and instead she took herself off to London, found herself a job. But then she was, you know, she's an artist, Mazzetti, and one day she just walked into the Slade School of Art and she demanded that they give her a place. And they said, that's not, you know, that's not how you get a place at the school. You have to apply and show us your work. And she said, no, I want a place at the school. And she started to make a ruckus in the front reception area and she wouldn't go away. And out comes a man in the shirt sleeves and says, what's going on here? And she says, I want a place at this school. And he says, well, why do you want a place at this school? She said, because I'm a genius. And she showed him some work. And he said, OK, you can have a place at this school. Mazzetti, in her first week or so at the Slade, she walks along a corridor and she finds a cupboard full of film equipment. So she takes the film equipment, and though she's never made a film before in her life, she gets a little group together of friends that she's made, and they make a film based on Kafka's Metamorphosis. And then she goes on to make a second film. And the second film that she makes goes to Cannes and is widely applauded by critics and by audience. And then Lorenza Mazzetti has become, as it were, one of the core members of the free cinema movement, who in the UK in the 1950s basically changed the possibilities for film. Mazzetti also has a backstory, as it were, and her backstory, which is at the core of this novel, is that she was related to Albert Einstein, and that and I'm not going to tell you that story, but the play between Mazzetti as the artist and Einstein as the thinker and worker with time and space, a union of possibilities between these two figures, and also a revelation of the darknesses at the core of the 20th century.
Indeed there is. And another character also is Charlie Chaplin. So how does Charlie Chaplin work himself into the story?
Well, Chaplin has just been there as a constant through all the four of these books. I know that figure that Chaplin invented at the beginning of the century is the same as the wanderer figure that Odysseus, that Homer talks about, and that ancient story has always talked about, the outsider, the tramp, the wanderer, the vagabond. Those, as it were, figurings are with us for all the centuries because they are always with us. And more than ever, this is the story of our time, Kay, is the outsider, the person who's supposed to be excluded, not permitted, who's on the margins of society, and the ways in which societies will deal with or will allow for or will not allow for the people crossing the world looking for a home.
One of the other novel characters is Ashley, and she is the new partner of Grace's ex-husband, and she is an expert in the meanings of words, but she has in fact become mute because I don't know, has she given up on language? What are the points you're making there about language?
Oh, I don't know. Characters come and they bring with them their stories. And Ashley came, and her own story is that she is so appalled at the reduction of humanity and the reduction of the humane and political language that as she starts trying to write a book about political language, she stops being able to speak altogether. That's what her character brought me, which was a realisation of the way that language, which is our greatest tool as human beings, it's our most important and subtle and versatile of tools for communication. The ways in which now politics is done by a three-word tweet or a kind of moment, a thrown-away slogan. The sloganeering in us, it reduces us to slogans, where language can open a world for us and can make us multiply able and multiplicitous as we are as beings in the world. So as right now, there's a choice, you know, there is a choice about how language all around us is percolating into us and being used and using us. So something about Ashley's vision, shall we say, is aware of the, you know, the muting of what political language has become.
Ali, now that you've finished the quartet and presumably you will take on maybe a more conventional project, what have you, like, is it going to change the way you're going to move forward in your writing?
I'm just laughing at the notion that I'll choose a more conventional anything. I've never had a choice.
Yes, it's presented to you. You'll take on the hard task.
It's always been, it's just the task, you know. Sometimes it's hard and sometimes it's not hard. It's just whatever it comes in, it asks questions. I mean, for me, I wish I could write, you know. But you can't, you know, I have to write what I write. And it comes in its form and it asks questions about structure. Always. So that's what I presume I'll end up doing that for all my life, really.
Well, Ali Smith, thank you very much. Ali Smith is the author of Summer, and it's published by Hamish Hamilton.
Why you trying to call me, wasting all my time? You know I'm in my zone. Me and all my girls, we gon' chill, chill the world. You know we're not alone. Light up a spliff for a cigarette and blow that all night long. And if you can't get to me, please just leave a message. You know I'm not at home. I'm not at home, I'm not about. I really don't like when you try and wear me out. I really don't like when you're acting like a child. Turn me upside down, turn me inside out. Babe, I'm done playing games with you. I think it's time to make a change with you.
That's Abby Coulibaly. She's a young Dublin singer-songwriter, another interesting addition to the Dublin thriving hip-hop R&B scene. She's just released that single you've heard. It's called Taurus. Recorded and released 50 years ago in 1970, the band Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young, they were a supergroup, and the name now rolls off the tongue as if it was around forever. But strangely, they lasted for no more than 18 months, and their flame burned brightest all of 50 years ago. In 1970, with the release of their acclaimed album Deja Vu, the group, such as it was destined never to last given the competing songwriting talents and egos. But their musical legacy and influence was enormous, and music journalist Pat Carty is here to talk about that legacy. But let's listen to a track from that album first. This is Carry On.
Now witness the quickness with which we to say.
That was Carry On from Deja Vu by Crosby, Stills, Nash and Young. And I'm here with Pat Carty, who knows all about Crosby, Stills, Nash and Young. It's amazing, isn't it? We do know all those names, Crosby, Stills, Nash and Young, as they stick together. But they were around for such a short period of time singing together.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, we know them now, of course, because we're looking back 50 years, as you say. But even at the time, these gentlemen were already famous from other bands. They came together. As you said, it all lasted about not even maybe a year, year and a half. The first album came out in, I think, March 1969. That's Crosby, Stills and Nash. This Deja Vu we're talking about came out in March 70. They did a tour. And for the first time, they went their separate ways at the end of that tour, which is July 70. So you're talking about a year and a half.
Right. OK, so tell us about them all. Give them their Christian names and tell me where they originated.
Right. Well, you're talking about Stephen Stills and Neil Young will come along later on. They were both in a band called Buffalo Springfield in the late 60s. People will know For What It's Worth is a very famous 60s song. David Crosby was an original member of The Byrds, one of the songwriters and guitar players and singer. And Graham Nash was in the English band The Hollies.
And how did they come together? Why did they come together?
Well, what happened was David Crosby, first of all, was... these bands all break up and lose people. David Crosby was fired out of the Byrds for being a bit of a not nice person, I suppose is the best way to put it. And he had hooked up with Stephen Stills. Buffalo Springfield had played the Monterey Pop Festival, which is in 67, I think. And they became friends, and they started, once he lost his position in the Burrs, they started hanging out. Graham Nash wanted to get out of the Hollies. So they met in Joni Mitchell's house, as you do. They were introduced there. Stephen Stills and David Crosby were already writing songs. They played a song. They played it twice. And Graham Nash said, just play that once more. And then he made up the third part harmony on the spot. And then they just looked at each other and went, here, lads, I think we have something here. And that was how that band came together, first of all.
And now, they had left their respective bands at that stage, or were some of them just on the cusp?
Yeah, the Buffalo Springfield had broken up. Crosby, as I said, had been fired. Graham Nash was still kind of in the Hollies, but the Hollies wanted to, I think what he said was the Hollies wanted to do things he didn't want to do. They wanted to record an album of Bob Dylan covers in a Las Vegas kind of big band style, and he just went, nah. And you know, the songs he was writing, they were turning him down. So he was still technically, I think, in the Hollies at that stage.
And they're all American bands except for the Hollies.
The Hollies. Yeah, yeah. I think Graham is from Manchester, I think, originally.
Okay, so they had success in America, and that's why they were based there. So it's interesting that you say they met in Joni Mitchell's house, because obviously Graham Nash and Joni Mitchell became an item.
They did.
And you might, by way of introduction, tell us about that to the next song.
Before even that, David Crosby and Joni Mitchell were an item. And David Crosby produced Joni Mitchell's first album, and she got a bit tired of him. Apparently he was parading around and showing her to people, but you know, opened a few doors for her, I'm sure, as well. And then Graham Nash and Joni Mitchell got together, and before, I mean, I think they were already broken up before this album came out, but if the song you're going to play is Our House. Yeah, it's about just their relationship together. It's a very simple scene that they went apparently and bought a vase and brought it home, and in the spirit of the time he wrote a song about it.
Life used to be so hard. Now everything is easy 'cause of you. And I
So that's Crosby, Stills, Nash and Young and Our House, written by Graham Nash for his then girlfriend Joni Mitchell. I don't know what David Crosby thought about that, but
I'm sure he was delighted.
Delighted. He had, moved on with life.
It sold a lot of records, so I'm sure that made it easier. Right?
Now, Joni Mitchell is very important to this album. There's also another track.
Yeah, there's a track on it called Woodstock, which Joni Mitchell wrote, and fans of Joni Mitchell will know it in her own version, which is a more acoustic version, obviously. This version is a full band version. Apparently, Stephen Stills worked it up in a jam with Jimi Hendrix and then brought it into the band, did it that way. I mean, the Woodstock Festival itself is very important to this band in how they changed from Crosby, Stills and Nash to Crosby, Stills and Nash and Young, because the first album came out, did very well, and obviously they had to tour, but Stephen Stills had played an awful lot of the instruments on the first album, so they needed someone else. They needed extra musicians. And it was Amit Ertegun, the head of Atlantic Records, who had signed them, who suggested, well, why don't you call up Neil Young, who was in the band Buffalo Springfield with him. Some of them weren't crazy about the idea, but, you know, they were convinced.
He's a fantastic artist.
Well, he is a fantastic artist, but Graham Nash felt, well, why do we need him? We're a fantastic artist on our own, you know. And I think what he did was he came in and he played them a few songs, and it was all over then, bear the shouting. And so he was brought in to do the tour, but their first show was in Chicago, supported by Joni Mitchell, strangely enough. And then the second show, the very second show that they ever played, was Woodstock. Which is incredible when you think about it. And already the splits were there. I mean, they play the show and you can see the footage of them and they're kind of nervous, but you can't see Neil Young in the footage because he apparently insisted when he went up on stage, said, look, you're not photographing me. And that was, you know, he's already been a bit cantankerous there at the start. But it was this great moment of the counterculture, and then they were always identified with it. And then by doing the song as well, it kind of set them up as these heroes. So really, when they went to record this Deja Vu album, you know, all they had to do was go in and not fall over, and they were pretty much on a winner, really.
And was Neil Young cantankerous and curmudgeonly, or were they all a bit egotistical and just couldn't get on?
Well, I think that's probably what, you know, they split more times than I've given up smoking, to be honest with you. So,
and that's, you know, a lot.
It's a fair few times, yeah. And I mean, Neil Young, I would suspect Neil Young, when he was asked You know, Neil Young was already doing his solo career, but he was asked to be in the biggest band in the country. So surely he probably thought, well, this is not going to do me any harm. It's not going to do my profile any harm. But I would say he was he always had his eye on the door, I would say. And then, you know, they're all hard to work with. I mean, to be a rock star, you have to have a huge ego, but David Crosby certainly fulfilled that criteria exceptionally well.
Now, we heard them there, and, you know, they've got this gorgeous overlaid three-part harmonies. That does not really compare with the likes of the other musicians out at the time. When you think of Jimi Hendrix again at Woodstock, or then there was Creedence Clearwater Revival and Eric Clapton. Very different sound, isn't it?
Well, I think
how did people take to?
I think there was a kind of
harmonies.
You know, it wasn't just Crosby, Stills, Nash and Young. There was a kind of a movement away from that. If you think of the first couple of Band albums, the Byrds had done a country album with Sweethearts at a Rodeo, and even Dylan had done a country, you know, softer albums. So there was. Even the Rolling Stones with Beggar's Banquet has a lot of acoustic music on it. So there was a kind of a split, but it was very much the year of the guitar hero, I suppose, what you're saying there. So Hendrix and Jimmy Page and Eric Clapton and all this. So it was, I mean, a turning away from that. But then it turned out to be a huge influence on what happened in the early 70s.
Right. So you said that you were talking about Crosby, Stills and Nash. This is before Young joined them.
Yeah.
And they had an album of the same name, and there was a song called Marrakesh Express that we're going to play. Just tell us a little bit about that album.
Well, it's more an acoustic album, I suppose, than the second album. Marrakesh Express, as you'll hear in the lyrics, is very much of its time. It's gone off to Marrakesh.
Probably, I wonder why.
Probably to get your hands on the local produce, I presume, was what was going
we're
on.
We're not talking camels now.
No, we're not. Certainly not. It might be transported on camels, I suppose. But it's a different album in that it's more of an acoustic album. And when people talk about their acoustic music, that's more the one that they're talking about. But the second album then is more a full band album.
Okay, we'll go back to Deja Vu, but let's have a little listen to Marrakesh Express.
Don't you know we're riding on the Marrakesh Express? Don't you know we're riding on the Marrakesh Express? They're taking me to Marrakesh, all on board the train. All on board the train.
I've been saving all my money just to take you there. I smell the garden in your hair.
So that's Marrakesh Express from Crosby, Stills and Nash. So as you said, Young didn't, he stuck around for Deja Vu. And how important is he on Deja Vu? What tracks does he contribute?
Well, there's his own song, a very famous song called Helpless, which people will know maybe from the band The Last Waltz, the movie. And there's a song called Country Girl. But he doesn't contribute as much as he might. I mean, it's more of a Stephen Stills album. That, you know, we played Our House and there's another song called Teach Your Children, which is very much Graham Nash. So it's kind of like the White Album in a way, in that it's solo albums squeezed into one. You know, there weren't that many band sessions. People would do their own songs and then bring in the other people as they needed them, you know.
And you talk about the importance of radio. I suppose you would have seen radio in the past as being stations that played singles. But suddenly in this time, 60s into the 70s, people were beginning to play album tracks.
Yeah, I mean, you're talking about the rise of FM there, and I suppose by the time we get to this in 1970, you know, you've all the college stations, things like that. So there were, you know, bands like this didn't have to really, I mean, while they had hit singles, they certainly did, they didn't have to worry about that so much, because there were people out there who would, you know, take the whole album when it came out and play a side of it, and people would be sitting there with their headphones, and maybe they'd have some of that stuff that the camels were bringing across the desert or whatever, and they'd relax into it, and it created a different kind of atmosphere. So it made heroes out of these people, because, you know, the era maybe 3 or 4 years earlier where they had to, if they're in the Hollies or the Byrds, had to worry about hit singles, they didn't have to care about that anymore.
Now there's another track which isn't on Deja Vu, but it's like an offshoot of it. It's called Ohio. Tell us why that's important.
Well, on the 4th of May 1970, as most people know, there was four students were shot in Kent State University by the Ohio National Guard. Now everybody was very affected about this. They were protesting the war and Nixon
in Vietnam,
had sent, yeah, exactly, and Nixon had sent them in. So It was Neil Young who wrote the song. I think he was given a magazine by David Crosby. They recorded on the shootings took place on the 4th. They recorded on the 21st, and it was in the shops by June. You know, the whole record company got behind it, and really with a song like that, that really cemented their reputation as the heroes of the counterculture. And also, we're talking about AM and FM because it mentions Nixon in the lyrics. It was banned on a lot of AM stations, but FM stations would play it. You know, and it really made them heroes. I mean, even the B-side, We Want to Get Very Nerdy, was part of the Easy Rider soundtrack. All these kind of things fed into the same thing, you know?
Okay, let's listen to Ohio. Ohio there from Crosby, Stills, Nash and Young. We've got some texts. I love this group forever since Buffalo Springfield and the Birds. That's from Brona. Graham Nash is from Blackpool in Lancashire and not Manchester. That's put you in your place,
I
Pat.
Corrected. I do apologise to the good people of Blackpool.
So Pat Carty has been talking to us about the short-lived supergroup Crosby, Stills, Nash and Young 50 years after the peak of the band in 1970. Thank you so much, Pat.
Thank you.
That's it all for tonight's programme. Research was by Paula Shields. Kieran Cullen was on sound. Janice Furphy was the broadcast coordinator, and the programme was produced by Olin McGowan.